This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio. Good morning, I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Earlier this year, WUWM highlighted racial disparities in our Project Milwaukee series, Segregation Matters. The series looked at the history of segregation in the city and how it impacts things like housing, healthcare, and education.
Those last two issues are at the heart of Elizabeth Drame's work. Drame is the chair of the Exceptional Education Department at UWM. She prepares special education teachers for work, coordinates the Autism Spectrum Disorder Certificate Program at the School of Education, and plans the annual Urban Autism Summit.
Her work has brought her to Senegal, Ghana, and Kenya, where she helps schools develop inclusive education models for the special needs students.
Much of her work focuses on the unique challenges that face special needs students of color. Drame spoke with Lake Effect's Joy Powers about some of the problems African-American communities deal with in diagnosing and helping children with special needs.
I think Black communities in the United States are really faced by systemic disparities that I think are grounded in institutional racism. And so those disparities, I think, compound to the point where we have a disparity in the diagnosis and the overrepresentation of Black people in special education. So kids who are looked at as being problematic and troubling, being identified as having, for example, a behavior disorder, or being viewed to not be speaking correctly, so they're viewed to be having a language disorder or something like that, they end up getting over-identified when they really don't necessarily have a disability. And again, that system of separation and segregation happens through the special education process oftentimes. So there's systematic, I think, disparities in healthcare, in housing, in access to healthy foods, in jobs that provide a living wage for families so that they can access the same resources to supplement education throughout. All of that compounds, and we see that play out in schools as well, too, because Black families and Black students oftentimes, due to systemic problems with adequate housing and all of that, have access to schools that necessarily don't have great outcomes as well. And so you see kind of this layering of challenges, okay? And then when you look at the representation of African American children in special education, that I think reflects a lot of different historical inequities and disparities.
One of the things that you mentioned is the lack of diagnosis, mm-hmm. that often children of color aren't diagnosed the same way that their white peers might be. Has there been some research into why that is?
There is research to support this. So if you look at the data, you'll see that for disabilities that are kind of obvious, right, like deafness, blindness, physical impairment, those kinds of disabilities, you pretty much see what you would expect in terms of percentage of different types of populations being diagnosed with those disabilities. But when you look at the more subjectively or diagnosed disabilities, and what I mean by that is disabilities that occur more frequently and that are reliant on clinical judgment. There's no like blood test, there's no vision test or whatever, there's no genetic test to be able to say you have a learning disability or you have a behavioral disability. There are various different scales, interviews that you do with parents, different diagnostic assessments that you do with kids, which also have historic biases in them as well. Then it's up to kind of looking at the data as a whole and the diagnostician, clinician, psychologist, whoever's doing the assessment, the evaluation, to come to a determination. And oftentimes, educational diagnoses come through the school setting as a result of a teacher referral. The kids who get diagnosed, you have to initiate a teacher referral if you're doing it through the educational system and not outside through a medical diagnosis. But the teacher's decisions are typically supported. Like their perception of a child as having a disability is typically supported within the diagnostic process. There's a lot of subjectivity embedded within that entire process. And then a lot of times families really will believe what the professionals are telling them, whether or not they feel like there's a different thing, there's something else going on. So there's I think, a lot going on that impacts the representation. Like, for example, if you look at behavior, there isn't a statistically different rate of Black children who fight more versus white children, for example. But if you look at ratings, and this is the discipline disparities data that you can look at, but if you look at disparities around the subjective behaviors like swearing, threatening behavior, violent behavior, disrespectful behavior, behaviors that really depend on the adult's interpretation of that child's behavior, that's where you see huge disparities. You know, you see black kids who are seen as being more disrespectful or more violent or more disruptive. Well, those are defined by the perceiver, whereas a fight is a fight is a fight. A weapon is a weapon is a weapon. That's very clear. Drugs are drugs are drugs, right? And so when you look at those kinds of offenses, you don't see the kinds of disparities, but you do see disparities where it's based on subjective perceptions.
So switching gears a little bit, I know part of your work has been in several African countries, Senegal, I believe, Kenya, Ghana. Mm-hmm. How does your work there compare with what you do here in Milwaukee?
Well, it's actually very similar, frankly. So the work that I did in Senegal back in 2011-12, it was funded by a Fulbright Research Fellowship. And I worked with a segregated private school for children with developmental disabilities and then a public school for children with physical disabilities. And basically, I did a participatory kind of evaluation project to do a needs assessment with those centers to find out what their needs were and also to better understand why those children were in those separate settings and why they weren't being educated in general schools. And one of the things that emerged was several of the kids at the private center for developmental disabilities, they had Down syndrome, different kinds of more obvious or known disabilities. And then they also had a group of kids with autism. And so I worked more closely with those teachers of children with autism because they really needed more support in understanding how to work with them, understanding why they were doing certain things. Why did they only eat things that were red and not anything else, not any different colors? Why did they eat it in a corner? And as I worked with them, I started to understand that the families of these children were really struggling to understand their child and what they needed. And because on the surface, they look very, quote unquote, normal. But then why are they screaming, or why are they hitting, or why are they biting, or why are they not eating with the family, which Senegal is a very collective communal society. You know, family is the nexus of everything, really. And if you have a child that's sitting in a corner taking their food and sitting in a corner, there's something really wrong with that child in the parent's mind. And so what I had to do was one of the things that we did with the teachers, as it was kind of like a train the trainer type approach where I would train the teachers, they would implement the interventions or strategies, and then we would kind of do debriefing. And so one of the things we did was we invited parents to watch these sessions, and then we had a discussion with parents, and come to find out with this one particular child that the dad was spanking the child because he was viewing him to be very disrespectful based on his behavior, but then through the observation of the interactions and the intervention session, they understood that where the behavior came from, that the behavior was a result of specific triggering factors and not because the boy was trying to be rude or disrespectful to his father. And so that ended up changing some of the dynamics within the home. And so I think those kinds of things, I think every family struggles with, no matter what cultural context you're in. If you don't really understand the nature of the disability and you don't have the strategies as a family and you're not equipped, or even as a teacher and you're not equipped, it's very easy to take some of the behaviors personally and take it as defiance and opposition and really not be able to work with or work through some of the behaviors.
One of the terms that came up when I was reading the UWM article about your work is many of the families seem to believe their children were bewitched in some in some way. And I think when we hear that, we go to like, oh, they believe in witchcraft and like magic and all these things. But how did that perception of children being bewitched, how does that compare to families in the United States, in Milwaukee or New Orleans, where you've also worked?
Right. I think there's more understanding in different communities here about what underlies, what are potential causes of autism. But I do think there's still a lot of people who don't necessarily understand because, frankly, the field isn't really clear about what causes autism. We know that there's some genetic factors. We know it's a neurodevelopmental disorder. But there's a lot of of ideas of, you know, maybe it's food or maybe it's vaccines or maybe it's, you know, environmental toxins or something. And but we're not really sure. And so it's very, I think it's you go to what you know and what you believe to be able to try to explain and understand what's happening, because it is a process of acceptance when a child is, you know, has a condition like autism, for example. It's a process of acceptance and developing understanding and being able to understand that if that child is not using the bathroom and they're 12 years old and they're not independently using the bathroom, they have to be told that it's not something that's willful or that it's, you know, something that they're doing on purpose, so to speak. So when in communities like in some communities in Senegal or even Ghana or wherever, or even Kenya, there's an effort to try to understand. If you don't have the information about this particular disorder in the first place, then you're going to go to what you know. So you're going to try to pray it away. You're going to try to give traditional medicines to help treat it. You're trying to do the best you can as a family. And I think what we need to do is equip families with information so that they can learn to accept their child as they are and to learn to believe that the child actually does have a wonderful future but will need really specific intensive supports in their schools, in their families. And then we need to wrap those supports around them. And in communities like in Kenya or wherever, those supports are much more scarce. They're scarce even here, all right? It's better, but they're scarce even here because of the level of intensity of intervention that's needed early on to really improve the long-term outcomes.
So what are you working on right now? Where is your research going?
So one thing that I'm working on right now is I'm working with a group of amazing African-American moms of children with autism, and we're working on a book. And one of the things that in my research that I've realized is that when you want to try to understand the unique perspectives of groups such as Black families, there's very little out there to understand their very unique journeys, in particular around navigating autism in their families. And so I've worked with this group of moms over the years on planning with the Urban Autism Summit on a variety of different panels and things, and talked to them and said, you know, I really think your voices need to be heard. And then we came together and we developed a friendship and came together and said, how do we do this? How do we get how do we get these stories out here? And how do we help the audience who would hear those stories? For example, the medical professionals, the educators, the law enforcement. How do we help them to better understand what our unique experiences are so that that these professional communities that interface with families can learn and do better? Because they've had some really challenging circumstances throughout the time that they've had a child with autism. And so that's what we're working on. So we will see what happens with that.
I look forward to seeing it.
Thank you. Thank you.
Well, thank you so much for speaking with me, Elizabeth, and thanks for sharing your work.
Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
Elizabeth Drame is the chair of the Exceptional Education Department at UWM, and she spoke with Joy Powers. You can learn more about her work by going to wuwm.com.